This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, can the standoff with North Korea be resolved peacefully? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Days after trading incendiary rhetoric with U.S. President Donald Trump, who warned Pyongyang that it would be met with, quote, fire and fury if it continued to threaten the United States, North Korea's Kim Jong-un rescinded its most recent threat to attack Guam, a U.S. territory. Over the past month, Pyongyang has engaged in a series of increasingly provocative and illicit actions. On July 4th, it test-launched its first intercontinental ballistic missile, a weapon capable of hitting the United States. Then, on July 28th, Pyongyang tested a missile able to hit the contiguous United States. These actions prompted another round of unanimous UN Security Council sanctions on August 5th, to which leader Kim Jong-un reacted defiantly, calling them, quote, a frontal attack on our republic and a violent infringement on our sovereignty, unquote. Meantime, U.S. intelligence officials concluded that North Korea has successfully produced a miniaturized nuclear warhead that can fit inside its missiles, crossing a key threshold on the path to becoming a full-fledged nuclear power. Officials have also raised the estimate for the total number of bombs in the communist country's arsenal. Pyongyang's determination to push ahead with its missile program, despite increasing international pressure against it, has bedeviled global powers. And with us to discuss the magnitude of the threat posed by North Korea and if and how the standoff with the recluse dictatorship can be solved by peaceful means are two distinguished analysts. Anthony Ruggiero is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and that's a think tank based here in Washington. Prior to his post at FDD, Anthony held numerous senior positions in the U.S. government, including in the Department of State and Treasury. Most recently, he was a foreign policy fellow in the office of Republican Senator Marco Rubio. And Harry Kazianis, he's senior fellow for defense policy and senior editor at the Center for the National Interest, a think tank also based in Washington. Harry is a frequent and valued voice on North Korea at these VOA microphones. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Harry Kazianis, let me begin with you. You've been here many times at these microphones talking about this, and yet we seem to be at a different juncture. What do you make of the latest brinkmanship between the United States and North Korea?
Well, I think I would offer first, this feels very different. And I think the reason it feels very different is the recent Washington Post report, which basically, if you break it down in very non-wonky terms, essentially tells the United States and the international community that North Korea has arrived as a nuclear power. And furthermore, they have arrived at the point where they have, I would at least offer, a credible capability to likely hit the United States with a nuclear weapon. Now, we can make intelligent arguments if, you know, they're 6 months down the line, a year down the line, if they have a crude capability, you know, could they target something as big as a city? But we've reached the point of no return where we have to stop talking about stopping North Korea from getting nuclear weapons and the capabilities to carry them aloft to the United States. They have them. So the hysteria in some of the different media outlets that you see in the sort of some of the crazy talk, it's because we're at a Sputnik moment once again. We're back at that point where 60 years ago in 1957, when the Soviet Union had the capability or was very, very close to having that capability to hit the United States with a nuclear weapon. So we're having to relearn that history all over again. It's a little painful, but that's where we are.
Anthony Ruggiero, how do you see it? Have we reached, as Harry said, a Sputnik moment? Does it feel different now?
I agree. Unfortunately, you know, you ask the question, what have we been doing for the last 10 years? And that's a real question that we have to ask ourselves. I think that routinely, and we've seen this even recently, is, you know, we underestimate North Korea's technical abilities. I think there's an effort underway to sort of downplay the threat, unfortunately. Initially, it was suggested that one intelligence agency had this assessment. Now it sounds like multiple intelligence agencies. You know, I spent some time in the intelligence community at the beginning of my career. North Korea is the hardest of hard targets. but we shouldn't really downplay what they've been doing. I mean, this is their goal. It looks like they've reached their goal. Sure, there are milestones they still need to hit. They don't want to hit the downtown part of the city. If they don't hit the downtown part of the city and they hit the suburbs, that's good enough for them, which I know is very alarmist, but that's kind of where we are. And it leads me to, you know, return to where I started, which is what have we been doing the last 10 years? And what we've been doing is, unfortunately, downplaying this threat and not making it a foreign policy priority. And by kicking the can down the road, we've left President Trump with this burgeoning threat to the U.S. homeland.
Turning back to you, Harry Kazianis, so if that's the case, that we've been kicking the can down the road, we've been sort of downplaying the threat, do you think the United States has a strategy? We witnessed over the past week, you know, dissonant voices, President Trump with rather aggressive rhetoric, threatening to attack, which of course then was dialed down by other staffers and senior administration officials. The administration doesn't seem to be on the same page. What is the U.S. strategy?
Well, we do have a strategy. That the challenge here that makes this all very hard to sort of break down is that Kim Jong-un making these fiery talks through his propaganda outlet, you know, the Trump administration and President Trump himself coming out with these very, very tough tweets. We have to remember, we can't formulate foreign policy in 140 characters. We can't formulate foreign policy on Twitter. We have to watch the actions of both of these two parties to understand the situation. And I think where this goes is very simple. You're going to see the Trump administration push through a very, very tough containment strategy, or containment on steroids, if you will. What that looks like is tremendous pressure on China, which you're already seeing now, to actually enforce the UN Security Council resolutions. But basically, if we're going to stop North Korea from getting to the next level of nuclear development, which is a hydrogen bomb, which is a three-stage ICBM, that's basically a missile that can hit all of the United States, no question. We need to constrict the amount of resources that are going into that country. If we can do that, we're not going to be able to take out the weapons they already have. We'd have to have a war to do that, and that would kill millions of people, most likely. But if we can at least stop the development of where they are, we can at least contain the threat. That doesn't mean we have to love the threat. It doesn't mean we have to embrace them as a regular nation, but at least we can stop them from where they're going. And I think that would be progress.
Turning back to you, Anthony Ruggiero, for your take on how you see the U.S. strategy evolving after all these war of words and seemingly disparate positions coming to a more coherent policy vis-a-vis China's influence vis-a-vis these new UN sanctions, for example?
Well, I guess this is the place where I'm the optimist, you know, which is rare for someone that follows North Korea. I believe that there's a way to roll back these programs. It's not an easy way to do it. I think it has an element of what Harry is saying in terms of containment, but I think you have to go even further. When you look at North Korea's revenue streams, we all know that they treat their people horribly. I mean, they have political prisoners, 100,000 or more, that are subjected to torture. They frankly don't care about their people. They have been compared to Nazi Germany and others in the 20th century, which is an apt comparison, unfortunately. But when you look at their revenue streams, from my perspective, they go to three key areas. They go to their nuclear weapons and missile programs, they go to their military, and it goes to buy luxury goods for their elites. And so when you talk about, however you want to describe it, maximum pressure and engagement, containment, the newest buzzwords from the administration are peaceful pressure, trying to distinguish between using military threats and economic coercion. However we want to describe it, the goal needs to be to force Kim Jong-un to make a decision between those three streams. Right now, he has the ability to do whatever he wants. And two of those streams, the military and the elites, are the ones that are responsible for keeping him in power. Now, I'm not calling for regime change, but I'm saying that North Koreans need to start having to make some decisions between those streams. And the question here is, will the weapons programs be number one in that stream in perpetuity? And then he will start to risk the elites and the military being unhappy with his leadership. And that's not easy. It's a tough process. Having worked on the Iran sanctions process, I can tell you that it was not easy. But if we dedicate enough resources to it, and it's not a unilateral thing, we need multilateral help, not through the UN, but sort of autonomously, that if we move that forward, there is a way to do it, but it's going to be a tough road.
Well, picking up on that, Harry Kazianis, do you think the United States has the leverage to pursue what Anthony Ruggiero suggested, you know, peaceful pressure, military threats, and economic pressure? And do you think China and other key players, particularly China, will begin to see eye to eye with the United States, at least with respect to containing and hopefully rolling back North Korea, because they don't want any spillover? And yet it seems like the United States and China just see the problem differently.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head here. Speaking with Chinese officials over the last couple of weeks and sort of polling them to see what their thoughts and feelings are, they always return back to the same line. And we don't like the status quo with North Korea. We don't like North Korea having nuclear weapons or chemical weapons or whatever weapon you want. But we're more afraid of pushing the regime over the edge and having them collapse. And what different Chinese officials have told me is that if they fully enforced the sanctions or they enforced a future oil embargo or something like that and the regime started cracking, they have some fears where there would be maybe Kim Jong-un deposed, some sort of North Korean civil war, and people lobbing nuclear or chemical weapons at each other. I think it's always important to look at the other side's viewpoint, but I think they're probably embellishing that a little bit and embellishing those fears a little bit. But I think there's a larger problem here. The United States for far too long has taken the Asia Pacific and as well as the challenge of North Korea and also China just way too lightly. I mean, I don't want to go on any sort of partisan talk or anything like that, but we seem to have this foreign policy approach where we declare sort of a pivot to Asia or something like that, and we don't put the resources to make it happen. And then we start going to other parts of the world trying to work on whether it's Syria, the crisis over Ukraine, and we don't have a grand strategy anymore. That was obviously easier to do during the Cold War, but the bigger point is we need to be able to set priorities and then stick with those priorities, no matter what's happening around the world. And I think this is the real test with North Korea. It falls out of the news cycle, then it ends up becoming the fifth or sixth biggest problem, and nothing gets done. We need to stop that.
Turning back to you, Anthony Ruggiero, how can we stop that if we see, for example, in the State Department and many other important government agencies, we don't have the assistant secretaries, the political appointees in place? Some are saying that this is a handicap for the United States, that we don't have these sub-cabinet level positions. To what extent do you think that constrains the United States? And what about China?
Well, certainly it would be useful to have political appointees in those positions, but the career appointees that are in those positions are very capable people. So I think the administration would benefit from having political appointees, whether those are career foreign service officers or political appointees in those positions. But I think that the sort of pointing to that and suggesting that that's the reason that the strategy has some flaws, I think a little overblown. In terms of China, you know, I've said for a long time, at least since I left the government, is that China is not a partner here. And I think that the concerning part of this administration's strategy is that we seem to go back and forth between treating China as part of the problem and treating them as a partner. And I'm very concerned that the new sanctions resolution was an effort by China to just delay action against Chinese companies and individuals and banks that are facilitating North Korea's sanctions evasion. Yes, it's awful that this administration has to make the tough decisions, because the last two, Republican and Democrat, decided not to make these decisions. It's a bipartisan policy failure, unfortunately. We had numerous opportunities to call China at the very beginning of this process and say, we're not going to just accept UN resolutions that are not self-enforcing, but we decided not to do that. And now we have what remains, which is a nuclear-capable missile that can hit the United States. And the Chinese are not just going to wake up one day and send their security agents to Dandong, which is in China is one of the biggest problems. They're never going to do that. The only way they might do that is if their own interests are threatened, whether through economic sanctions, whether through military developments in the region, whether THAAD is deployed now, whether things of that sort are deployed more often. I think that the Chinese have to face the choice of why are they protecting this dictator that has nuclear weapons now.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Anthony Ruggiero, from whom you just heard. He's senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and Harry Kazianis, senior fellow for defense policy and senior editor at the Center for the National Interest. And we're discussing North Korea's provocative behavior and how the international community can thwart Pyongyang's nuclear ambitions. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Gimba Solomon Malachi. He's a loyal listener from Zaria Kaduna State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Harry Kazianis. Let's talk about the region, you know, South Korea, who is most imminently affected, you know, God forbid if North Korea launched any kind of attack. How do they see this in the U.S. and Chinese position? How can you reconcile that?
For the South Koreans, I think we forget about them in this whole thing, to be honest with you. And that's really a tragedy because, just as you pointed out, they would be the ones most impacted by really any scenario. A couple years back in 2013, I was involved in some different war games that actually gamed out in 2020 what a second Korean War would look like. And I have to tell you, we ran the scenario three different times, and each time it escalated further and further. In the last scenario, 8 million people died. That's because the North Koreans actually had ICBMs that could target the west coast of the United States. That's where we are at this point. In terms of South Korean sort of public opinion, there is actually some information just that came out that the South Korean conservatives have essentially, in their party platform, come out with language that they would support the United States actually bringing back nuclear warheads to the Korean Peninsula. So I think it starts to show you that there is a tone that's changing in South Korea. You know, when the current administration came into office that was center-left, they had ideas of maybe talking with the North Koreans, maybe bringing back what used to be called the Sunshine Policy of negotiation, of trying to have joint development with the North Koreans. I think that's dying a very quick death at this point. And to see South Koreans start advocating for maybe the return of nuclear weapons, and to tell you, I've heard South Korean politicians even advocate for their own nuclear weapons, as some Japanese politicians have called out for, the North Koreans are creating a very dangerous situation.
Well, back to you, Anthony Ruggiero, on that very point. Whether it's South Korea or Japan now talking about proliferation, about creating their own nuclear program, I mean, this can only lead to a worse scenario. How do you see the region and, again, the United States leadership in trying to contain this and be the nuclear umbrella as we try to go forward and contain North Korea?
Right. This is a very dangerous situation. It proves that North Korea is a global proliferation problem. North Korea has a history of proliferating their nuclear material. And now it looks like we're moving in a direction where, as Harry said, if we have a question that is always asked, I think this was all asked during the Cold War, would the United States be willing to trade Los Angeles for Seoul or Washington for Tokyo? And that's where you get the calculus in South Korea and Japan of how long will this nuclear umbrella, which is, you know, the term used that the United States will protect non-nuclear countries if they're either attacked or there's some suggestion a nuclear attack against them would be responded in kind. But the question here is, with North Korea's continued ICBM development, will they see that nuclear umbrella is no longer worth it? And then if they go nuclear, how long before countries in the Middle East start asking the same question about the Iran nuclear deal, which we all know that is really no more than a freeze? And given North Korea and Iran's close relationship, I'm very concerned about what would happen after the Iran nuclear deal down the road, where Iran could then go to a completely nuclear North Korea that has an ICBM, and then that could set that region in a downward spiral as well. That's to say, all of that to say, to go back to my point on China, this is not in China's interest. These are against China's interests, who wants to not only be a regional power, they want to be a global power. And if there are nuclear states being developed right in their own neighborhood, how many countries are going to trust them when it comes down to it? And I think the Chinese are hopefully starting to realize that.
Well, back to you again, Harry Kazianis. To talk about this goal, I guess, of denuclearization, Henry Kissinger, of course, the famous former National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, opined in the Wall Street Journal, essentially saying, you know, substantial progress toward denuclearization and its attainment in a brief period is the most prudent course. You know, he talks about the U.S. and China need to come to some kind of a consensus. First of all, do you agree, and how optimistic are you that we can do that in a short period of time. As you said, time is running out.
Well, who am I to disagree with the astute knowledge of Henry Kissinger? I think we have to look at this from the North Korean perspective. As gross as that is to do, I think it will bring us some wisdom here. If we think about the North Koreans and why they want nuclear weapons, they want nuclear weapons for one simple reason: survival. That is the number one thing here. The challenge with North Korea is that they look at history and they look at a powerful United States that has overwhelming conventional military capabilities. And if we wanted to impose regime change, we could do it. Would a lot of people die? Absolutely, but we could do that. They look at things like the war in Afghanistan. They look at the first and second Gulf War. They look at Libya. They look at Kosovo. And they see a United States that if they want to change the international system in ways that they want to, they can do it. So they've made a calculus that it is in their interest to have nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them on the U.S. homeland. And they're even willing to starve their own people to do it. So denuclearization, I think, is a good long-term goal, but we have to figure out some way to give the North Koreans the incentive to give up those weapons. I just don't see that happening. What I think eventually happens here is we go back to the Cold War playbook of containment and deterrence. I just don't see any other way. The Trump administration has been given a bad hand, and they're going to have to play it.
Back to you again, Anthony Ruggiero, to talk about the motivation of Kim Jong-un. He wants to survive at all costs. And, you know, to what extent we can try to pursue this goal of denuclearization, or is it too late? You know, how do you see going forward? What about the six-party talk framework? Is that even on the table anymore? That used to keep things going forward, but are we at a point where it's too late for that type of diplomacy?
I think Carrie's right. Survival is their primary goal. I would just add in that maybe their medium-long-term goal is reunification of the peninsula, too, which, of course, having nuclear weapons helps them to that extent. In the sense that when I talked about trading cities, there's also the sort of sub element of that, which is at some point when we believe they can demonstrate fully their nuclear capability in the sense of delivering it to the United States, then does Kim feel emboldened that if he moves south, that the United States would be reluctant to come and support our ally? That's a dangerous situation, obviously. But back to Dr. Kissinger's op-ed, you know, I think part of that, if I remember correctly, is that working with China, trying to come up with some kind of understanding on denuclearization or the goal where North Korea should abandon all nuclear weapons and its nuclear weapons programs. And when you talk about negotiations, there are a lot of people out there that are suggesting we should just jump right to a freeze, that it's too dangerous. We've tried that numerous times. I think if this crisis continues, the administration that's focused on negotiations should be thinking about how they structure those negotiations. And the only way, in my mind, to structure those negotiations is an upfront demonstration of North Korea's commitment to denuclearization. But this is where I'm the pessimist. I don't think that's going to happen with this regime and with this leader.
Well, then, last words. So, Harry Kazianis, can this be resolved peacefully, in your view?
You know, Carol, I think the thing I worry about more than anything else is someday we're going to wake up and we're going to discover that North Korea has tested an ICBM or a missile, and that missile's telemetry went bad and accidentally landed in South Korea or Japan or some sort of populated area. And then the South Koreans or the Japanese, they're going to feel like they need to respond militarily. What happens is the North Koreans will respond militarily. That's how wars start. Keep in mind, we're in August right now. August is the time of wars. We do not want that to happen.
All right. Well, the last word to you, Anthony Ruggiero, because Harry brought up a very good point: miscalculation and the role that could play in stumbling towards something that we do not want.
Right. I think that's right. I think there's the accidental that Harry's talking about, but I think there's the intentional miscalculation as well. I think that North Korea has this mentality provided to them in the past because of our inaction, that they can do things with impunity and there will be no consequences. And so my hope for this increased rhetoric that has happened from Secretary Mattis and the president is that North Korea finally understands there could be consequences for their provocative actions.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. We'll certainly revisit the issue of thwarting North Korea's nuclear ambitions in future programs. I'd like to thank my guests, Anthony Ruggiero, he's Senior Fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and Harry Kazianis, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy and Senior Editor at the Center for National Interest. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Appreciate your insights. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.